this week, what we've been doing for the last several weeks, we've been at it for about 3 weeks now, we've been sort of beginning the discussion with an exploration of key terms used, you know, in the sutra. And the key terms are ardently, so spiritual ardency, and clear comprehension, you know, what does clear comprehension mean, and mindful. So these are the three terms. He repeats it three times, you know, ardently, clearly comprehending, and mindful. So the whole discussion, you know, it's really important to kind of what we'll be doing is focusing on these three terms, spiritual ardency or spiritual urgency, and clear comprehension, and mindfulness. So today, we continue the discussion of spiritual ardency. What this means, you know, we are, you know, from the reading from Joseph Goldstein, you know, we talked about, you know, effort, purpose, surrender, you know, so generating energy, you know, for the practice and seeing a clear vision, a clear goal, and having this balance between, you know, present moment awareness and this kind of long-term vision of the practice. How do we develop a kind of strategy, you know, for pursuing the practice, you know, over the long term? So this whole discussion is related to that in terms of how do we determine what are the factors or what are the reflections that stimulate a sense of ardency, a sense of urgency in our practice. And in the previous weeks, we talked about various factors in the Buddhist teachings that, you know, have the quality of stimulating the sense of urgency. Now, I'll just list them very quickly. One was we talked about the whole rebirth process in terms of the overall spiritual cosmology of birth and rebirth, and the fact that even while we go from life to life, the life that we have within this lifetime is the only life that we will have in this body and this consciousness. There is something that goes to the next life, but it won't have the consciousness that we have in this life. So in essence, we only have one shot in this body, in this consciousness, if we want to be able to attain a sense of awakening, a sense of liberation. You know, this is the only time that we will have. So that gives us a sense of urgency. Also the rarity of being born a human being. This is one of the things that we don't often appreciate, the fact that we're actually a human being, you know, and not an animal or not a plant or some other form of life. So the fact that we are just in this human life is something that is not only rare and not only, you know, doesn't happen all the time, but being so should be the source of enormous gratitude for the privilege of being human. And it also sort of gives us a sense of the urgency of resolving, of attaining what can be attained in this lifetime as a human being. So this is a factor that builds a sense of spiritual urgency in our life. The fourth was the importance of the mind. You know, our ability to understand the importance of the mind and its fundamental preciousness in terms of the mind is the vehicle for our greatest happiness, our greatest peace, our greatest equanimity, our greatest sense of freedom, you know, and liberation. Or it can be the vehicle for our greatest suffering, our greatest pain, our greatest, you know, degradation as a human being. So the mind is really the vehicle for our liberation. So we really have to pay attention to the mind. And fourthly, the simple rarity of the opportunity to practice. The fact that each one of you are sitting here listening to the teachings of the Dharma is very, very unusual. I mean, think of it. You're probably part of less than 1% of the total population in terms of the circumstances that motivated you to come here to sit on a cushion and meditate and to be interested in something called Buddhism and the teachings of the Dharma, right? I mean, the fact that, but if you think about the power of the teaching and what the teaching opens up to you in terms of your fruition as a human being, the power, the preciousness, and the value of that teaching is so, so profound and so powerful, and yet so little, so few people know about it. So the fact that you're here, the fact that you're listening and you're learning about the Dharma is a wonderful golden opportunity for awakening, right? That is absolutely precious. Somehow the forces in your life have brought you to this place, have brought you to the teachings, so that you can, you know, travel that spiritual journey to free yourself from suffering. This is not, there's nothing less than that, you know, in this entire process. It's literally, it's freeing yourself from emotional suffering. So that is a gift. That's an incredible karmic gift that you've been granted in your life by your circumstance. So this is something to be incredibly, incredibly grateful for. The fact that we're born a human being, the fact that we have this opportunity, and the fact that you're even sitting in this hall today. You know, this is a culmination of causes and circumstances that brought to you to this point. And this doesn't apply to everybody. You know, a lot of other people are living totally different lives, going in totally different directions. And God knows they're probably in a world of suffering. So the fact that you are able to access these teachings and bring them into your life is something to be incredibly grateful and appreciate, you know, that we have this opportunity. So I'd like to continue today with this whole discussion of ardency. We're still talking about ardency in terms of spiritual urgency. So I'd like to begin with a story, and this is this comes from a teaching from Joseph Goldstein. He sort of conveys the story, but it's the story of a life of a person, a teacher by the name of Shakpar, who was one of the great Tibetan Dzogchen masters of the 18th century. Now, Dzogchen is a Tibetan Buddhist practice which is very similar to mindfulness meditation. Now, Shakpar was a wandering monk, and his teachings were beautiful. Now, the subject that we're talking about today in terms of spiritual urgency is the whole concept of impermanence, understanding what impermanence is. Okay, so things are impermanent. Now, how does that, what is the connection between the reality of impermanence and spiritual urgency, you know, feeling a sense of spiritual urgency? So Shakpar was a wandering monk, and his teachings were truly profound and beautiful, and they were often expressed in verse form and were a reflection on the transiency of life and how it can stir and arouse this feeling of ardency, of passion, of care for the practice. So this is Shakpar speaking. One day, I went out for some fresh air to a meadow covered with flowers. While singing and remaining in a state of awareness, I noticed among the profusion of flowers spread out before me, one particular flower waving gaily on its long stem and giving out a sweet fragrance. As it swayed from side to side, I heard this song, the rustling of its petals. And this was the song of the flower. an offering. My father and mother are the sky and the earth. I am the child nurtured by warmth and moisture. See how beautifully I display my fine petals, waving them in the 10 directions. They are my offering to the 3 jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Listen to me, mountain dweller. I don't want to hurt your feelings, but in fact, you even lack awareness of impermanence and death, let alone any realization of emptiness. For those with such awareness, all phenomena all teach impermanence and death. I, the flower, will give you, the yogi, a bit of helpful advice. A flower born in a meadow, I enjoy perfect happiness. My brightly colored petals in full bloom, surrounded by an eager cloud of bees, I dance gaily, swaying gently with the wind. When a fine rain falls, my petals wrap around me. When the sun shines, I open like a smile. Right now, I look well enough, but I won't last long, not at all. Unwelcome frost will chill these vivid colors, till turning brown, I wither. Thinking of this, I am disturbed. Later still, winds, violent and merciless, will tear me apart until I turn to dust. You, hermit, are of the same nature. Surrounded by a host of disciples, you enjoy a fine complexion. Your body of flesh and blood is full of life. When others praise you, you dance with joy. Faithful patrons turn up and you sit in a dignified manner. When they shower you with lavish food, you smile with satisfaction. Right now, you look well enough, but you won't last long at all, not at all. Unwelcome aging will steal away your health and vigor. Your hair will whiten and your back will grow bent. When touched by the merciless hands of illness and death, you will leave this world for the next life. Since you, mountain-roaming hermit, and I, a mountain-born flower, are mountain friends, I've offered you these words of good advice. Then the flower fell silent and remained still. In reply, I sang, O brilliant, exquisite flower, your discourse on impermanence is wonderful indeed. But what shall the two of us do? Is there nothing that can be done? The flower replied, I make this offering, an offering to the infallible 3 jewels. We too must now do as I say. Among all the activities of samsara, there is not one thing that is lasting. Whatever is born will die. Whatever is joined will come apart. Whatever is gathered will disperse. Whatever is high will fall. Having considered this, I resolve not to be attached to these lush meadows, even now in the full glory of my display. Even as my petals unfold in splendor, you too, while strong and fit, should abandon your clinging, meditate in solitude, seek the pure field of freedom, the great serenity. Now, what's so amazing about this story is that I think for many of us, for all of us actually, on some level, we know the fundamental truth of this story. We know that all things are changing. We know that nothing will last. We know that this body is going towards old age, decay, and death. But there's something missing. There's some part of our mind that doesn't really know it, that doesn't really deeply connect. And that, of course, is clinging to life, you know, not wanting death to occur. So I see the beauty of this practice, this opportunity to practice, is just deeply, deeply integrating this wisdom, you know, this wisdom of impermanence. Because when we see it clearly, the mind does let go of clinging. It does let go of grasping. We do come to abide in the great peace, a sense of great serenity. Now, there are certain things about this story and this whole idea of impermanence that I think are really important to understand. And in telling this story, I kind of go back to, you know, what I had been talking about early in one of the previous weeks, and I think those of you who were here know that I was speaking about a friend who I'm still actually in the process of speaking with and supporting and counseling. And this is a person who is in advanced stages of cancer. There are a number of things that I was reflecting upon. One was, of course, the relationship between our emotions and our physical health. So there was an unmistakable, almost one-to-one correlation between, you know, emotional stress and physical decline, physical cancer. So, you know, I don't know where modern medicine is today, but as far as this mind-body continuum is concerned, in my mind, there's absolutely no question about the connection between, you know, our mental state, you know, and our physical health. So, I mean, that was the one lesson. But of course, the other lesson is, you know, the acceptance of impermanence. And to whatever power I had was, you know, toward encouraging her to get well, you know, to reevaluate her whole entire emotional sort of sense of herself as a person and the conditions that caused her suffering virtually all the way through her life that, you know, caused the physical, you know, condition that she was facing. But the other side of it is, you know, if you don't make it through, then it's the facing of the end of your life and, you know, the facing of impermanence. And so as was stated in the story of the flower, the other side of impermanence is when you truly understand impermanence. Of course, it gave you great peace and it allows you to let go of clinging and holding on to life, holding on to things, holding on to your identity. But it also gives you the impetus to live life to the absolute fullest because you know that your time is limited. How many times, you know, have you heard stories about people who have near-death experiences, you know, who have had traumatic accidents like car accidents or traumatic diseases or, you know, out-and-out NDEs, right, near-death experiences, and have come back. And what do they invariably say, right? I've just, you know, now that I've seen, you know, what the end of life could actually be like, all of a sudden, my whole attitude toward my life has completely changed. You know, I know what's important now. I'm going to live life to the fullest. I'm going to be completely, you know, mindful, completely present. My entire mindset is completely changed. It's because they've seen the impermanence of life. So this is a natural phenomenon. So what I'm trying to sort of say here is that impermanence is not, you know, impermanence is a fact of life. You know, we all know that. we all acknowledge that at some deep level, as difficult as it may be for us to accept it. But if we were to truly accept it, you know, in terms of its true significance, that should free us to really look at our life with a new, or with a renewed sense of urgency, with a renewed sense of, you know, ardency, you know, to live a life that's full, to live a life that's the complete, you know, realization of our potential as a human being, our talents, our gifts, and also to realize our capacity for spiritual awakening, because the time we have is short and limited. It really is. So if you think of it that way, you know, it should really be an impetus, you know, a strong, you know, stimulus to really pursue spiritual knowledge, pursue meditation, to pursue the spiritual path with a real sense of urgency, a real sense of dedication and commitment. So, you know, because the time we have is limited, and, you know, we may be reborn in the next life, but that next life will have a different consciousness. It won't be aware of this life, who we are in this life. You see what I'm saying? So, in essence, this is the only chance we have. So, you know, if you truly understand that, you know, existentially within yourself, that should really motivate you, you know, to look at life as a tremendous, tremendous opportunity and a gift to be appreciated and lived to the fullest in whatever way you possibly can. I think that's really, really so, so important. Now, another lesson that came to me from this whole interaction, which took me a while to sort of formulate in my mind, and I share it with a sense of maybe as a hypothesis, you know, that I submitted for your consideration. And that is the nature of change, transiency. Now, this woman who I've been working with, she's in her, I would say, her early 60s, late 50s, early 60s. And at one point in her 20s and 30s, she was really beautiful. I mean, she was, you know, model beautiful. I mean, she had looks that, she had photographers taking pictures of her, and she was a model. And so she had this just amazingly beautiful face, and just a beautiful woman. And naturally, you can imagine, she is completely devastated by the loss of her appearance, her beauty. And, you know, so she's permanently lost the vitality and beauty that she had as a young woman. And I think part of her suffering has to do with this loss of who she was and the ravages, you know, of her disease. I think for all of us, and you've probably had this thought, particularly if you're older, maybe in your 50s or 60s or approaching your 70s, that as we age, right, there comes a time when you start looking old. You know, the fullness of your cheeks begins to recede, you know, the bone structure becomes more apparent, you know, your jawbone sticks out, you know, your lips, your face. You know, you become more gaunt-looking. And what I've noticed, and I don't know if you've thought about this yourself, but as one ages, the faces that start to arise sort of fall into certain kind of categories. I mean, there's like almost a finite sort of category. People with sort of protruding jaws or recessive noses, or, you know, deep, sallow eyes. And your appearance literally changes. You know, you're not the beautiful young woman or handsome man, you know, with the fullness of your face and your body, but you become very gaunt, you know, your posture changes. You literally become physically a different person. You don't look like, you might have a vague resemblance how you look when you're 30 and 40, but when you're, you know, 60 or 70, you know, your appearance is completely different. And the fact is, you're a different person. You're not that person that you were when you were 30 or 40 or 20. So if you were, you know, 50, 60 or 70 and grieving the fact that you weren't looking like the way you were at 20 or 30, you know, I think you're in a world of trouble. You know, you're holding on to an idea of yourself that just isn't real. You know, you're not that person. You're a different person. You look completely different. You might have a vague resemblance to who you were when you were 20 and 30, but, you know, you're a different person. So I was looking at, you know, I said, look, you need to be, right, and this is a person, she has a tremendous artistic and creative flair. She's also actually a wonderful, powerful public speaker, and she's been involved in public affairs, where, you know, working in sort of neighborhood politics, like neighborhood boards and things like that, and she's an advocate for, you know, advocate for, you know, the poor and, you know, injustice and stuff like that. So she's a very strong personality, very strong person. So I said to her, look, you need to be this skinny, bald-headed lady, you know, that's making a fashion statement out of being bald-headed, you know, and, you know, like being bald-headed can be a fashion statement. Get out there and go into these public forums and rant and rail like a real activist, right? Because when people see you, they don't see you when you were 20 or 30 years old. They see you how you are now. And if you have the spirit of an activist, of a creative person, of somebody out there in the public, you know, active person, they will see you for exactly who you are. They will accept you for who you are. And they will probably admire you for the fact that you had the courage to get out there and not be ashamed of your baldness, not be ashamed of your thinness, but admire your spirit and what you're trying to achieve. Because what you're trying to achieve is for the good, and everybody understands that. So it's not about your appearance. It's about recognizing and embracing who you are right now, not how you were 20 or 30 years ago. You cannot hold on to that. You have to let that go, because that's not you. That's who you were 20 or 30 years ago, but that's not who you are now. You have to embrace who you are now and be that person and go forward from there. And, you know, I think for a lot of us, that really describes, you know, our vision of ourselves, right? We're holding on to the past, whether it be in terms of our appearance, you know, our beauty, our vitality, or our job, or our identity, or things we've done, and we're not, you know, sometimes it's hard for us to accept the realities of the present, particularly if they're difficult realities that are hard to accept. But even out of that difficulty, you know, arises a whole new reality that we can embrace, not only embrace, but exploit for the fullest potential of what it can bring to us as an expression of who we are as a human being. So, to me, that's the real lesson. And so, you know, I was trying to tell her that you've got to let go of this image of yourself when you were 20 or 30 years old and just be who you are now and be proud of it and just flaunt it. You know, make being bald a fashion statement. And a lot of women do, you know. Go out to Neiman Marcus and buy some really nice clothes and go out there and, you know, kick ass, you know. Do, you know, be what you can be, you know, right out there. And when people see you, they will respect that. They will probably think more highly of you that you were able to overcome your difficulties to do what you set out to do. And in my mind, I have a role model in my mind. I don't know if many of you have heard of or knew of a woman called Aquam McElrath. But Aquam McElrath was a woman who was married to Harry McElmath, who was the founder, not the founder, but one of the leaders of the AFL-CIO, you know, the Local Five. He was a great union leader here in the history of Hawaii. And she was a Chinese woman who lived to be in her 90s, but was this amazing, articulate, hard-driving, intellectual, you know, person who people just admired for her courage and her visibility and her, you know, so speaking out for the rights of labor and the oppressed. And she was a, you know, she was a real icon in the labor movement for many, many years, and she died about 4 or 5 years ago. And I think she was in her late 80s or early 90s. But she was a woman who had that degree of respect and recognition in the community. It wasn't about her physical beauty. It was about her personality. It was about what she represented and what she stood for as a person. So this is, you know, really an expression of the core essence of ourselves. You know, finding that core essence and expressing it as a manifestation, you know, of who we truly are. And to me, this is really, you know, finding the truth and expressing the truth of who we are. And, you know, I can't think of a more powerful way of actualizing ourselves in the world by accepting the reality of who we are and living that reality, not holding on to the past, not clinging on to, you know, something, some idea of ourselves, some image of ourselves, or some sense of who we were that doesn't reflect the current realities. So it's this acceptance of change, you know, sort of reveling in change and bringing change, you know, and using change as a vehicle for the expression of our innermost talents, powers, and abilities. To me, that's really, you know, the essence of what living fully in the moment is really all about. And of course, embracing our impermanence. It's because the time we have is limited that we live to the fullest in the moment. So that's, you know, that to me is the ultimate lesson, you know, of impermanence. Impermanence may not be easy to accept, but once we accept it, you know, we can really, really use it as a vehicle, you know, to live life to the fullest, both, you know, in terms of our physical lives as well as our spiritual lives. It's so, you know, it's important to understand that, because once you have that foundation, it really empowers your life in a very deep existential way. You just do it because you know in your heart that you have to do it. And that gives you this, you know, this turns you into a force of nature. That's what people call, sometimes people call people, other people, a force of nature, because there's something that drives them from a very deep level that's just unspoken, and they know what they have to do, and they just do it. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to talk about it. You just do it. And that's, to me, that's what power is. Because you're drawing from a much deeper, vaster source than yourself. It's the source of your subconscious. It's the source of your knowledge of who you are and what your gifts are and how the Dharma flows through you. And when you have that happening, when you become that vehicle, you do become a force of nature. So it's really about, you know, self-actualization at that level. Now, one final thing on this whole discussion about spiritual ardency, is one last reflection that can help us to establish us in ardent practice, is realizing, this is really, really important, that the only things that can be said to truly belong to us, right? We talked about impermanence, you know, nothing's, you know, nothing is permanent, but the only thing, there is one thing, the only thing that truly belongs to us are the actions we perform and their subsequent consequences. Existentially, the only thing that truly belongs to us are the actions that we perform and their subsequent truths, consequences. what we earn from our actions. This is, you know, this is the return on karma. The Buddha reminded us often that results follow actions like a shadow follows a body. When we understand this, it can really strengthen our enthusiasm. We see that each action has a tremendous consequence in our life, whether it's positive and wholesome and skillful, or whether it's negative, unskillful, leading to negative, unskillful, unwholesome results. What are we doing with our lives? What are we doing with our practice? What are we doing with our time on this earth? What choices are we making for ourselves? So fundamentally, we really have to look at the choices that we make for ourselves in this life and what the consequences of those choices are. Where are those choices leading us? Understanding that and learning how to make the right choices so that we can, you know, we can reap, you know, wholesome and skillful consequences from our actions. So when we have this quality that the Buddha repeated in the refrain, with each of the abidings of mindfulness, saying, abide ardently. So ardency is all of this. This is what ardency means. When we have this quality, when we develop it in these various ways, it really strengthens what we could feel or think of as a courageous heart. This is what a courageous heart is. It's a heart that's open to life. It's a hope. It's an open to freedom. It's an opening to understanding, wisdom, and compassion. It really gives us the courage to be with all the many ups and downs of our life and our practice as we go through many difficulties. And we're not, you know, we will not be freed of difficulties. Difficulties will always arise in our lives. But this gives us the strength, it gives us the purpose, and it gives us the wherewithal, you know, to work through these difficulties, to negotiate these difficulties, and move through them, you know, with wisdom, with grace, with understanding and compassion and loving kindness. And this is really the whole meaning of the practice. So, as you know, this is not a practice of uninterrupted rapture and bliss. You know, this is really about facing life as it truly is. So we need that courage, and it's this quality of spiritual ardency, of spiritual urgency, of seeing the importance of having gratitude for the opportunity that we have in this life to be here, to be with the Dharma, to have the opportunity to awaken. You know, to awaken from greed, hatred, and delusion, and to seek, you know, freedom and liberation from our afflictive emotions, our suffering, really. Now, this is an opportunity. And if we understand what an opportunity is, you know, this should really, really motivate and drive, you know, our practice and the quality of our lives. So thank you very much. It's a pleasure to present these ideas today. If there are any questions or any comments that anyone might have,
Suzuki Roshi from the Zen tradition, yeah. He had a saying that always really stuck with me, which is, being born is like stepping into a boat that has a hole in it and is already sinking. You know?
Yeah.
And just the first time I heard that, I sort of went on this whole journey on my mind that that's really what we're doing. We're stepping into a sinking boat,
right?
But we still have somewhere to go in it, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, and to not be so overcome by the fear of drowning that we can't row anymore.
Yeah, we can't row. Yeah. It's well said. It's a great story, actually. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Absolutely. So you row like hell. Gotta get to the other shore before the boat sinks.